I often do. The web page for the class has got a link to the syllabus, which will tell you what we're doing when. It has links to various other things that you may find of use. Last time I taught this course, I used PowerPoints. I haven't decided whether I'm going to do it this time or not. I have somewhat mixed views of PowerPoints. However, if you like PowerPoints, the PowerPoints from 2 years ago are up on the webpage, and you can look at them. And the class is going to be only mildly different this time than it was last time. Have a sheet of paper, which gives you the web page for the class, but also an opportunity to tell me when you want your office hours to be, when you want my office hours to be. Your office hours are up to you. All right, the basic idea of the course is pretty simple, and that is that there are a whole bunch of things which you can't expect lawyers to be competent in, but it would be nice if they were familiar with. And that this course is a survey of those things. So we're spending sort of a week or two each on a bunch of topics where hopefully the end is that you won't be too easily fooled by people who are trying to use statistics to prove something that isn't true. You'll have some idea what accounting figures mean, and multi-gatorer. All right? Many of these could be a full course. The statistics would probably be more than one full course if you really wanted to be a competent statistician. And, in fact, one of them is a course which I am teaching this semester, namely my economic analysis of law class, because we're going to spend, I don't know, a week or two on economic analysis of law at some point this semester. And I want you to learn enough so that you understand at sort of a general level what's going on in these things, and we'll be able, if you ever really need statistics, you'll know where to start, as it were, to figure out how to do it, or when you hire someone else to do it for you, you will understand what he's doing, similarly for the others. Mechanics of the course is not invented by me. It was invented by some people, some of whom I know and some of whom I don't, at Harvard, and one of whom is on my list of very smart people, so I like stuff he does, and they wrote a book based on the course they were teaching at Harvard, and it seemed to me it was something that would be useful for, here, just a minute, sheet of paper. This is for you to tell me when you want my office hours to be, mainly. I figured it would be a useful course here, and so I've taught it for a few years. And, you know, obviously, as you can see, it is not a course that appeals to a great majority of the student body, but some people, I think find it useful. So you ought to do the reading. Since I didn't give you an assignment in advance, I am assuming that a few of you may have read the first chapter of the book because you thought it would be useful, and others haven't, but I'm not going to assume you have, but you should have read it by Wednesday when we'll have our next class. And ideally, you do the reading. We then come into class, and I say, are there things in the chapter that you didn't understand or wanted to discuss further? And we do that. I've wanted to teach a class, sort of my ideal way of teaching a class, which I tried once many years ago and have never tried again, is to tell the students, all right, tell me what you don't understand. When we finish discussing that, the class is over. And somehow enough people are unhappy with that approach. I should say, when I tried doing it, the text was what I had written. So I sort of figured the text already told them what I had to say. But a lot of people want to get things once in writing and once spoken, so I'm willing to go along with that. So as I say, you should read the stuff. The syllabus tells you what you're supposed to read by when. Discuss it in class. On the syllabus, there is homework, which is generally not going to be graded. It is simply stuff for you to do and that will be discussed in class. If for some reason any of you don't like getting your information off the web, I can produce hard copy of the syllabus and stuff and give it to you. But my guess is that by this point in history, everybody in the school is used to doing stuff off the web. Probably the students a little bit more used to it than the faculty. So there will be a midterm. From my standpoint, the main function of a midterm in courses I teach is to provide information to students, because found especially in economics, but to some extent in this, there's some risk of people thinking they understand stuff when they don't, and having to actually apply it is a useful test. There's a book somewhere which is a sort of a told-to book by Richard Feynman, meaning he didn't write it, but he was the source of the information. And he has an account of physics somewhere in South America. Feynman, as you may know, was a famous physicist. And his account was basically that the physics grad students in the place he was didn't know any physics. They could talk to you about physics, but they couldn't actually do physics. And the nice thing about a midterm is that it gives you a chance to check on whether or not you can actually do the stuff that we're doing. The grading will be basically midterm and final. The final weights a good deal more heavily than the midterm. Anything else? Any questions about the mechanics before we go on to, I was going to give a sort of a brief survey discussion of what the topics are and then start on the first one. Anybody? Everybody's fine. Good. All right. First topic, which we'll be starting on today, which is the first chapter of the book, is decision analysis. And decision analysis is basically a way of doing formally and explicitly what everyone does all the time anyway, but it's useful to actually sort of graph it out, as it were. So you have, you're an attorney, you've got to decide whether to settle or to go to court. You are somebody buying, or the attorney from someone who's buying a piece of land. He's got two alternative pieces of land, one of which is less expensive, but the less expensive one might have a pollutant problem. And so, which one should you buy, or should you pay something to test the one that might have a problem and then make your decision afterwards? So basically, decision theory, as we'll be seeing later today, is a way of sort of structuring the decision problem to say, well, these are the choices I have to make, these are the random elements that are to occur, these are the payoffs and costs associated with each of these, how would I figure out what I should do? And in one sense, it's empty in that the decision theory doesn't tell you how to get any of those numbers. It doesn't tell you how to find out what the probabilities are or the payoffs are. But it is very useful because it tells you what questions to ask. It means you ought to say, all right, here is the uncertain point. What's my estimate of the odds that we'll win this case? Here is the point where there's an outcome. What does my client think about this outcome? Does my client regard a 50-50 gamble between $100,000 and zero as equivalent to a $50,000 sure thing? If not, how much of a sure thing is it equivalent to? Therefore, which choice should we take, to settle or go to court? So it's a moderately useful way of just getting explicit the kind of decisions that people make all the time. Second thing we'll be discussing is game theory. And it's going to be a very brief discussion of what could be, again, a very long and detailed subject. But the essence of game theory is that it deals with situations where people interacting, and where what I do depends on what you do, and what you do depends on what I do, what's sometimes referred to as strategic behavior. And that turns out to be a very, very hard problem. There was a man called Johnny von Neumann, who a few of you may have heard of. He was a mathematician and a number of other things. And one Nobel Prize-winning physicist commented on somewhere or other, I don't remember where, that there are two kinds of people in the world, Johnny von Neumann and the rest of us. And von Neumann more or less invented game theory. And it was a very, very ambitious project, because if it had succeeded, if he had really found a way of solving all games as he defined it, that would have been economics, political science, negotiation, a whole bunch of different things, all of which involve strategic behavior. And I suppose if you think of some very, very simple games, you probably all know scissors, paper, stone. All right. Well, it's an interesting question. In what sense is there a solution to a game like this? Because, of course, whatever you do, if the other person makes the right other choice, he wins. Von Neumann could answer that question. And he could answer it for games a little more complicated than that. But it turns out that the Von Neumann succeeded in solving one small subset of games in some useful sense of solution, which we'll discuss a little bit. And other people have been working on the project ever since. And there are a bunch of solution concepts, of senses in which one can describe something as this is a solution to this strategic problem, none of them entirely satisfactory. And we will be running through a few of those. And again, I would say that game theory as a way of getting a clear and unambiguous answer to questions isn't very useful. Game theory as a way of understanding problems better is quite useful. That I think... The next subject we'll be discussing is one where I think this may be the most useful one to you as lawyers, and that's the question of applying various ideas, largely economics, to drawing up contracts. If you ask, how ought one to design a contract? And in addition to the book, I've also got on the syllabus a link to an article of mine, which actually came out of several different courses I was teaching. And the article is called From Imperial China to Cyberspace. And it's about contracting when you don't have court enforcement of contracts. It turns out one of the courses I teach sort of every other year is a seminar on legal systems very different from ours, which is quite a lot of fun. And one of the legal systems we look at is Imperial China. There turns out that when China ceded Taiwan to Japan about 1900, the Japanese decided that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on the island, they would just enforce Chinese law. And in order to do that, they had to find out what it was. And so there was a large scholarly project of Japanese scholars around 1900 to research Chinese law in Taiwan. And there's some modern stuff that uses that as an input. And it turns out that China essentially had no contract law. Indeed, it really had no civil law as we understand it. That if I lent you money, you didn't pay it back. There was no way I could sue you. All I could do was report you to the district magistrate as a swindler, criminal law. The district magistrate might tell you to pay money back. He might tell you to pay half the money. He might say, forget about it. But it was up to him, not to me. Despite this, China had very elaborate contractual practice, even by modern standards. That is what looks like modern contract law in terms of what we're actually doing, but not the law. So one of the fun problems is, how do they do it? How do you manage to have contractual practice without enforcement? And that's a question that ought to be of great interest to you, because although it's true that you do have court enforcement, it's also true that you don't want to use it. Right? If you think of yourself as a lawyer drawing up contracts, you'd like to draw up contracts in such a way that neither side ever has to go to court. It's cheaper and easier and pleasanter that way. And so looking at legal systems where they have that constraint helps you figure out how to do so. So that's sort of my addition that isn't really in the book. But the book is mostly about using sort of economic ideas to design contracts. Not the book, that chapter is the book. The second half of the article, of my article, has to do with the fact that in cyberspace, it is very hard to use court enforcement because national boundaries are invisible. You may not even know who you're dealing with, depending on the details of the contract. And therefore, in cyberspace, again, you face the issue, how do you deal with people if you don't have the alternative of going to court? And I argue that to some extent, you end up with analogous solutions in both worlds. So I thought it was a fun article, so I thought you'd enjoy reading. The next section is the one that I learned most from the first year I was teaching this course, and that was accounting, because I knew nothing at all about accounting. The first rule I've discovered, if you want to understand accounting, is avoid the words debit and credit, because they usually mean the opposite of what you think they do, but not always, just to confuse things. I have an old blog post on that subject, which was sort of fun. But I think the book does a reasonably good job of understanding at sort of a basic level what accounting is about. One of the things that I found interesting reading about accounting is that accounting has got the same bizarre pattern as tort law. That is that all probabilities are one or zero. All right? If you think about it in tort law, if the conclusion of the court is that the chance that you were negligent was 30%, how much damages do you owe? Under ordinary, there are lots of fancy things, but under ordinary, I'm not talking about dividing responsibility among multiple people. The question is, we just don't know. There are facts we don't know, and our best estimate is that 30% chance the injury was due to your negligence, 70% chance it wasn't. How much damage do you owe? Zero. Very good. Preponderance of the evidence. Make it 60% and you owe 100% damages. So there's a sense in which tort law acts as if all probabilities are one or zero. So does accounting. I'm sure there are exceptions, but as a general rule, when you're drawing up your accounts, if you've got a lawsuit and your attorneys say, we've got a 70% chance that we won't be held liable, you put that in as a negative asset of zero. On the other hand, if it's only a 30% chance that we won't be held liable, you put it in as a negative asset of the amount you will have to pay if you lose the case. And I thought that was sort of neat, and that I think there are reasons in both cases why both systems do it that way. But anyway, basically, what you'll be doing is just trying to make sense of T diagrams and various, income statements and a bunch of things of that sort. It's a sort of a mechanical system with its own
odd but elegant logic to it that I think you need to know. Then we discuss finance, which I'm not going to try to summarize. It's not really my field, but it's ways of thinking about financial results over periods of time, basically, which is relevant to lots of decisions other than grant finance. There's then one section which I haven't taught before because I just invented it and is not in the book, but something that had occurred to me would really be a very useful skill to be able to have. And that's what's sometimes referred to as back-of-the-envelope calculation. There are a lot of situations where you don't really care whether a number is 10 or 12, but you do care whether it's 10 or 1,000. And so back-of-the-envelope calculations is techniques and tricks and such by which you can get very approximate estimates of the size of something. And when you go up on the web page and look at my look at the syllabus, there's a link to something that I wrote up, which is a few pages long, which is a brief explanation of the idea, and then some examples where you might do it. Sort of one of my standard examples is that every once in a while you have a water shortage. And how do you know you have a water shortage? Because you walk into your favorite restaurant and there are no glasses of water on the table. Instead, there's a little sign which says, out of concern for our current water shortage, we will bring you drinking water if you ask for it, but we aren't wasting water by putting it out and you don't ask for it. Well, you might like to know, is this actually a way of dealing with a water shortage or is it pure window dressing? They're probably doing it because the city government asked them to. I think that's the usual pattern. I think it's usually not required, but obviously a sensible restaurant don't want to offend the city government, which licenses them. And so the question is, how could you do rough estimates to figure out whether the amount of water being saved is 5% of water consumption or 1 millionth of water consumption? If it's 1 millionth, then you should say, all right, this is window dressing. This tells me that the mayor wants us to think he's doing something. Whereas if it's 5%, well, you know, that's quite a sizable reduction. So that's one example of the kind of problem. That's not a very legal problem, but it's just one that I've come across and done the arithmetic for occasionally. So anyway, I have a, when we get to that or before, if you feel like looking at it, I have several problems along those lines. One I actually ran into quite recently. I was reading a book by Freeman Dyson, a moderately prominent physicist who's an interesting guy, and he mentions in passing something that I had heard elsewhere, that Henry Ford, clever man that he was, created a mass market for automobiles by paying his workers enough so they could afford to buy his automobiles. And I suggest you do, if that sounds plausible, do the arithmetic. The question is very simple. How does the number of people working for Ford compare with the number of automobiles he was selling a year? If the answer is it's 1%, then how much he paid his workers has a negligible effect on how many automobiles he sells. And putting it in verbal terms makes you not do that arithmetic. When you just say, you know, he paid his workers enough to buy his cars. But you ought to ask that question, and your first guess ought to be, this is obvious nonsense. I should say I emailed Dyson pointing out with detailed numbers that it was nonsense, and he, being a very nice guy, emailed back saying, thank you, it's much more useful to be told when I'm wrong than when I'm right. And one of the neat things about the world at the moment, by the way, is that when you read a book and you want to say something to the author, you can, with any luck, find his email online, send him an email, and if he's the sort of person who doesn't mind arguing with his readers, you get an answer. And I happen to have, I've been on both ends of that particular transaction, but in the last month, I emailed two different authors about their books, one of them Dyson and one of them somebody who'd written a science fiction novel that I liked, but I thought had some problems in it, and in both cases got friendly responses back. So it's sort of a nice thing about our super technological communication system that you people are all taking for granted and that still seems miraculous to some of us ancients. All right, so that'll be the back of the envelope calculation. I sort of squeezed it in. I think I'm taking one day out of microeconomics in order, that is out of what I did last time in microeconomics, so that we can talk about doing that. We then go into microeconomics, which is a terrible term and ought to be called price theory, that the terms microeconomics and macroeconomics are one example of the general pattern of using terminology to make people think they understand things without actually going to the work of getting them to understand them. Because it sounds as though microeconomics is about the small scale and macro about the big scale. But if you actually look at it, the world wheat market is a problem in microeconomics.
All right. So that actually microeconomics is price theory. It's understanding the ways in which markets work and in which prices act as to signal people what to do and to affect behavior. It's sort of the really the core of economics, which was worked out about a century ago by Alfred Marshall, based on work by other people. And it is, I would say, the part of economics we understand. Macroeconomics is basically disequilibrium theory. It's the theory that in microeconomics, most of the time you're assuming that everything is working out, so to speak. That people aren't making mistakes, or if they're making mistakes, they've got probabilistic calculations, just like decision theory, and they know how many mistakes they're making. And the trouble is that that analysis, which is beautiful and elegant and all works, has certain implications that don't seem to be true. For example, there is no such thing as involuntary unemployment. All right, markets, clear. If an input such as labor is currently in excess supply, the price of that input goes down. As it goes down, people offer less of it, people buy more of it, and supply equals quantity, demand, your own, finish. So the part of economics we understand doesn't really answer questions such as why are we currently have a high unemployment rate. And the answer to those questions depends on parts of economics, which, as far as I can tell, we don't understand very well. It's not my field, so I may be wrong. But I've usually, my standard line on macroeconomics is that a macro course is a tour of either a cemetery or a construction site, either of old theories that we're pretty sure are wrong or of new theories which we disagree about whether they're right. So anyway, but microeconomics, that we understand and that we can do, and it is useful, I think, in doing in various legal contexts to at least understand what the economic arguments are. Especially useful if you happen to be planning to be before Judge Posner, since he's a guy who believes in the relevance of the economics of this. But quite a lot of other judges are going to. I mean, even if you don't believe in it, it's useful to understand the arguments. And if you do believe in it, it's also useful to understand the world. I should say, in my view, economics is not about the economy. The economy is just one of the things economics have used to understand. So that the question, for example, of why marriage is much less stable now than it was 100 years ago can be thought of as an economic question from my standpoint. And I don't mean it's about money. I mean it's a question about the implications of rational choice, which is that from my standpoint, the core assumption of economics is that the best way of predicting the behavior of people, especially people you don't know, is that they tend to take the actions that achieve their objectives. That's what we mean by rationality. And that approach can be used to explain all sorts of things. My first published article in economics was a theory of the size and shape of nations, in which I at least claimed to explain the general pattern of the map of Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the present via a model in which nations are competing for territory in a certain rational fashion. It was quite a lot of fun. I was sort of proud of the fact that a couple of years ago I came across somebody's summary of the literature on the size of nations. First article, mine. Second article, 10 years later, by Jim Buchanan, and then various articles by other people. So that was sort of neat. But anyway, but my point is just that economics is about lots of stuff, although it's mostly people conventionally apply it to certain particular things. So we'll discuss economics. We'll then go on to discuss law and econ, which is the other course that I'm actually teaching this year. And law and econ is, obviously enough, the application of economics to understanding the law. And the one way in which I sometimes start my class is to say, imagine that you are in a legal system where the most severe punishment is life imprisonment. Somebody points out that armed robbery is a very serious crime and suggests that therefore it should be punished by life imprisonment. And a legal philosopher says, is that just? And a constitutional scholar says, is that cruel and unusual punishment? And an economist says, do you really want your armed robbers to routinely shoot their victims? Because after all, if the punishment for armed robbery is the same as the punishment for armed robbery plus murder, the additional punishment for the murder is zero, and people are rational. So that would be one example of the general approach, which says, think of legal rules as an incentive system. Think of legal rules as not as this good, bad, just, unjust, but given this rule, how will people respond? What will they do? And I think it's a very useful and powerful way of making sense of the law, not the only possible way. To take a very different example, a lot of people feel that when the legal system, when criminal law makes serious mistakes, somebody ought to pay for them. So suppose you have an innocent person who's convicted of a serious crime, spends 20 years in jail, and then the DNA evidence shows that he was innocent, and perhaps that when you go back and look at the case, it's clear that there was never good reason to convict him. And the gut reaction is, all right, he is owed $1 million or so damages, maybe more than that. It ought to be paid by the DA and the cops and the people who are responsible for getting him to jail. Suppose we had a rule like that. One consequence, one desirable consequence, might be that prosecutors would be more careful about not convicting innocent people. What would the other consequence be? What? No, we can try to, maybe, but that would depend on how good the odds are. What nice, innocent minds you all have. The other consequence would be, yes? That would require very high compensation. No, the other consequence I'm concerned of is that when they did convict innocent people, they would never find out. They'd make sure they never found out. Right? You're penalizing people for the combined act of convicting an innocent person and being discovered to have convicted an innocent person. Well, it's already the case that in many jurisdictions it's hard to get permission to do DNA testing because, not surprisingly, people don't want their mistakes discovered. If having your mistakes discovered means you lose your house and your life savings, the reasons not to have it discovered become a whole lot stronger. So that would be an example of the general economic approach, of which ideally ought to be applied not only to tortfeasors and victims and criminals, but also to judges, cops, prosecutors, and everybody else. We don't do it well enough in law and econ, but at least we can make some attempt. But anyway, we'll go into that in much more detail, obviously. The next subject is statistics. There is a famous book which some of you might want to read, which is called How to Lie with Statistics. And what it's really about is how not to be fooled by other people who are lying with statistics. And we'll talk a little bit about those issues and more generally about sort of what statistics is, what it means. As far as I can tell, a majority of people who use statistics don't understand what they're doing. In the sense that, and they think they do. Let me take a very simple example. One often gets statistical results stated in the form of a number. When they say, this has been, we've supported our theory at the 95% level, or at the 0.01 level, which is a question of whether you're looking at the chance of one way or the chance of the other. 99 is the same as 1 in that sense. And the question is, what does that mean? And as far as I can tell, most people who report such numbers think that if you've confirmed your theory at the 0.01 level, that means there's only 1% chance that the theory is false. Indeed, that is not the case. Standard statistics does not give you that information. That's the information you'd like to get. What that 0.01 actually means is that if the theory is false, there's only 1% chance that the evidence would be as strong in favor of it as it is. Right? It sounds similar, but it's a very different statement. Because if you have a case where you say, well, it's very unlikely this theory is true. Well, the very unlikely the theory being true times if it's true the evidence will support it may not be more probable than the high probability the theory is false plus a low probability times the low probability of supporting it. My standard example for this is to say I'm going to pull a coin out of my pocket. I'm not sure I have any. I don't have any coins in my pocket at the moment, so I can't do it. But I'm going to pull an imaginary coin out of my pocket. And my theory is it's a two-headed coin. And it would be no fun to actually look. So instead I flip it twice. And sure enough, it comes up heads twice. The probability that if it's a fair coin, it'll come up heads twice is only 1 in 4. That doesn't mean that the probability that the coin is two-headed is now 3 out of 4. Why? Because almost no coins are two-headed. And it's therefore far more likely that I pulled out an ordinary coin and happened to get the 1 in 4 chance of 2 heads than it is that I pulled out a 2-headed coin. So that's a sort of a simple example of the sort of the kind of stuff I want people to end up understanding on what statistical numbers mean, because it's pretty easy to be fooled. Let's suppose, for example, it's a different issue, but that happens to be a real one at the moment. And that is, suppose somebody publishes an article saying, we can show that secondhand smoke has terrible effects very quickly. How do we show that? Here are 5 different cities where they put in a law against smoking in restaurants. And sure enough, the next year, the number of people who reported to have heart attacks in that city's hospitals went down. What's wrong with that? What haven't they told you? What would you like? What question would you like to ask them? That's the conclusion. The question is, what question would you like to ask people who did that study? Well, let's put it differently. Suppose you wanted to get that result. Suppose you are against smoking because you don't like the smell of tobacco smoke. I don't. And you wanted to persuade people that secondhand smoking does lots of damage because then you wouldn't have tobacco smoke in the restaurants that you eat in. How would you do the study in order to produce that result without ever lying to anybody? Yep. Such honest people. Yep. No, that requires lying to people. No. What you do is you do a quick first cut survey of 50 cities. You find the five where, after the rule went in, the heart attack rate went down, and you only report those five. All right. Yeah?
We have also done it by restaurants that had like a higher incidence of smoking, like maybe at the bar setting. You know, some restaurants don't have
smoking. But what they were doing, they weren't looking at restaurants. They were looking at towns that had passed a law, and then what happened to the heart attack rate. And the result was quite unbelievable if you think about it, because it was a very short time period thereafter, and at least all the evidence on smoking is that it's a cumulative effect over a long time, despite which the Surgeon General made pretty clearly false statements quite recently based on this. Somebody else did the study for all cities, basically. No effect. Basically, some cities goes up, some goes down, as you would expect. And one would like to know whether one would like to have the records of everything done by people who did the first study. I doubt them. But my point is just that as a lawyer, these things are going to matter to you, because you're going to have people who offer what they claim is statistical evidence for some relationship, and sometimes you should suspect that it's bogus in the way I describe. You should ask, how did they select their cities, basically? Now, there's the further problem, of course, of real fraud. I don't know if any of you have followed the recent story on the autism vaccination thing, but it turns out that particular litigation was based on deliberate fraud. That the person who did the study lied about the facts about his 12 patients and was being paid by a law firm that was planning to sue people on the theory that vaccination caused autism. That was a recent story in England in the last week or so. But that you're not going to be able to catch, right? If you as a lawyer are very unlikely to be able to detect fraudulent work, but you can detect people who are using statistics in order to fool you. We then do a further statistics which has to do with multivariate statistics. Somebody was raising the question of their other effects. So if you ask the question, does A cause B? Does the death penalty decrease the murder rate? Do required bar courses increase the bar passage rate? There are lots of cases where you would like to know a causal link. And the trouble is that usually the things you're looking at are caused by lots of different things. And so multivariate statistics is a mathematical technique by which you try to tease out what the effect of one variable would be if you held everything else constant. All right, and sort of the crude way of doing it is you could say, take a bunch of students, all of whom have the same entering LSAT score, and some of them took these courses and some of them didn't. What were the bar passage rates? But basically, multivariate statistics is a fancy way that doesn't require you to throw away 98% of your data first. It lets you look at everybody and try to see how different variables affect it. And I've been suggesting to various people a proposal for how law schools ought to be ranked, as it were, which would involve using multivariate statistics, because the problem is if you rank loss, what's wrong with saying we find out how good an education a law school has by what fraction of its students pass the bar? Why is that a very unreliable measure? Yeah.
Not all
that might be one reason. Other reasons? Yeah.
Might not show the quality of the education, but the incoming students.
Quality of incoming students. Precisely. That was your point is also a point, but that was the problem. That was that, you know, presumably most of the students who get accepted to Harvard would pass the bar if they went to Podunk Law School, if there is a Podunk Law School. And most of the students who get accepted to some law school at the bottom of the U.S. News and World Report would not pass the bar if they went to Harvard because they get lost in every class at Harvard. All right, so you'd like ways of separating out those effects. And indeed, ideally, what you'd really like to be able to tell students is not law school A is better than law school B, but law school A is better than law school B for this kind of student, and law school B is better than law school A for that kind of student. And you could use, in fairly straightforward ways, multivariate statistics to generate that kind of information. I don't expect it to happen, but it's certainly mathematically possible. So anyway, those are the topics we're going to be covering. And before I go on to start with the first one, questions on what we said so far? Anybody? Nobody? All right. So the first topic is decision analysis. And decision analysis is really just a way of formally setting up a problem in order to make it easier to decide what to do. And it involves, first decision is, do we have any pens here? We've got one pen here. Probably not really adequate for today's class, but we'll make do. So what you're usually doing is you have a choice, which we can represent by a box. I could do this or I could do that. The choice often has a cost. If we litigate, we're going to have to spend $20,000. -$20,000 on. Whereas if we settle, we don't have to pay anything. It then has, this one, let us say, has an outcome. The settlement offer they make you is $70,000. Plus $70,000. And this one might have an outcome. It might be you say, we know that we're going to win this case and collect $100,000. Well, if that's right, let's take that as the simplest example. Suppose we're sure we're going to win the case. Well, we then say the value of this branch is $70,000 minus zero. It costs us nothing to go there, and we get $70,000 out. That's accepting their settlement offer. The value of this branch is $100,000 minus $20,000. That's $80,000. $80,000 is bigger than $70,000, so therefore we should go to court. All right? So we then cross off that branch to mean we know it's the one we shouldn't take, and we write over here, I think, 80,000. Meaning that if we're at this point and can choose, that's the value of being there, because we're going to make the better choice. Then we get to more complicated cases. Suppose more realistically that you've got some probability of winning your case and collecting 100,000. And some probability of losing your case and collecting zero. Let's suppose that this is probability of 0.5, and this is probability of 0.5. Well, for the moment, and it's the point we're going to want to come back to, we're going to think of the value of a gamble as being what's called the expected value, the amount you would get if you did the gamble lots and lots of times over. So, on average, what's a 50% chance of $100,000 worth? And what's a 50% chance of zero worth? Zero. So, we say if we got this far, that's worth $50,000. Right? Just as if we just had a dot at the end with $50,000. $50,000 minus $20,000 is 30. 30 is less than 70. So, we restore this. We cross off this. And this is now worth 70,000. That's the basic logic of how decision theory works. You can do it in more or less complicated ways. And when you read the chapter runs through, starting with the trivial case to less and less trivial cases, how you would do it. And let me step back. a moment and discuss sort of, imagine that this is a much more elaborate graph where you had a series of choices, random events, and so forth. What do? You start at the right end, and you say, all right, if I got to here, this is my last choice, what should I do? Well, I can forget about everything before that for the moment, and just say, well, if I'm here, this has got, you know, whatever it's got. It's got some branches and some payoff and maybe something random. Random, I don't get to choose. That's nature choosing for me. What's this one worth? All right, well, let us suppose that doing that, I see, well, if I got to here, I'd never do this, and this is worth 8,000, say, whatever it is. All right, I can then erase this, replace it by a dot labeled $8,000. If we get this far, that's what we get, and work back. All right, so you're basically working from the right end of the diagram at each stage, saying, what would you do at this stage? We know what you would do, therefore we know how much it's worth to you to get to this point, so that we just, and then just keep going, and you end up, you've got a solution. All right, that's the basic logic of decision theory. It's not very complicated. And a couple of other things. First point is, where do you get your numbers from? And the answer is not from decision theory. So what decision theory will help you do is say, what numbers do I need? Well, I need to know, what do I think will be awarded if it goes to trial and we win? I need to know, what do I think the litigation cost will be? I need to know, what's my professional estimate of the odds that we're going to win? All of that information is needed in order to do your decision theory calculation. And the decision theory analysis just tells you, all right, go get that information. Where do you get it? Some of it is your professional expertise, all right? Some of it is you've tried cases like this before. You know about how often you win. Some of it is your client's knowledge. You go to your client and you say, look, let's suppose we can end up in a point where it's a coin flip, 100,000 or zero. How much is that worth to you? Well, if the client has got assets of $6 million, he's quite likely to say, well, 50,000, of course. I mean, anybody can do arithmetic. If the client, if 100,000, if the client's got assets of close to zero, on the other hand, his reply may be, I'd much rather be sure of having $40,000 so I can pay rent this year than having a 50% chance of 100,000, 50% chance of nothing. So that's the kind of question you would ask your client. And there might be others. There might be probability questions. When you say to your client, the probability question is whether or not some of your employees broke the law and dumped hazardous waste where they shouldn't. Well, even if, assume for a moment, the client doesn't actually know whether they did that, he has a better odds, better idea of the odds than you do, because they're his employees, he knows how honest they are, more or less, and so forth. So what you're doing is, if it matters enough, you could do research to get your numbers. You could say, all right, let's look at all cases similar to this that have been tried in this district in the last 2 years, hire some law student intern on the summer to go through all of those and tell us what the results were. That would be an example of research. And you could similarly do that for other things. How would you decide whether to do such research? How would you decide whether to improve your numbers? Do a similar analysis in which you say, how much does it cost to improve the numbers? How much is it worth to me? All right. And this is a point which is relevant to this. It's relevant to a lot of things. Let's suppose you're thinking about buying a new car, and you've got a trip to make. So one possibility is to take your old car and make the trip. That's what you normally do. Another possibility is to go to the rental car companies and rent one of the two cars you're thinking of buying. Make the trip, and that is going to cost you more. You have to pay for the rental. And then the next trip to it with the other car you're thinking of buying. Well, it's really a decision theory question. How much is that information worth to you? All right. You can find, by the way, quite sophisticated analyses of the value of information in books written by poker players. Because a lot of what's going on in poker playing, I gather, I'm not a player, my adult son is. He recommended one that book to me. It was interesting. And a lot of what's going on there is saying, all right, if all I care about is this hand, I should fold. But if I fold, I never find out what the other guy had. So how much is it worth to me to figure out whether this guy I'm going to be playing with for the next couple of hours is a bluffer or not? All right? That's a decision theory thing.
So let's run through a... Right. Let me run through. I thought I had some numbers to this. I guess I don't.
Let me run through a more complicated case, which involves the same basic principles. I'm not sure if this one is in the book or if I embedded it when I was teaching the course, but it's the same kind of one as the ones in the book. And we're going to. Well, let me start with one, and the one that's in the book, only I don't remember the numbers, so I'm not going to bother to look at them. This is the one where your client is thinking of buying a piece of land. And one piece of land is going to cost him $300,000, and the other piece of land is going to cost him $250,000. And he reports to you that he's a little puzzled about this difference because looking at the land, they seem equally suited for his purposes. And you say, well, have you checked about hazardous waste? He says, hazardous waste? And yeah, you know, they've been worrying a lot of this area about hazardous waste that got dumped in some places and not others 10 years ago, 15 years ago. They're expensive to clean up. So you say, no, I haven't checked with that. So you ask around, and it turns out that indeed this one, first cut, you say, well, this loop is obvious. You buy less expensive. Minus two. The book does these plus because they're thinking of them as calculating cost rather than calculating returns. They use the minus because the minus is applicable. Pay money. So if this is all that's happening, you would say, aha, obviously you buy this one. But we now discover that that's not really the story. That the real story is that minus 250,000 is the cost of getting to a random event. And the random event is some probability, let us say a 50% probability equal 0.5, that there's no hazardous waste, and we're finished. But probability equal 0.5, that there is hazardous waste, and the cost of cleanup is $80,000. Actually, that should be a dot here, and this is minus 80,000. All right. So, what, assuming that you're risk neutral, assuming you just treat everything as a gamble, what is this point worth? If you get to there, what is the value to you of 50% chance of not paying anything, 50% chance of 80,000? 40,000. So this is minus 40,000. So minus 250 minus 40 is minus 290. This is minus 300. Which branch do we cut off? Now, suppose, of course, if we push these numbers up and we made this 120,000, then this would be minus 60, and now we go the other way. All right. But now let's make it a little more interesting, because we're going to add a third alternative. And the third alternative is to test. We can pay to have the land tested before we buy it. It's going to cost us $20,000 to do that test. And the test has, assuming these numbers are right, there is 0.5 chance, sorry, down here, probability equal 0.5, that the conclusion is that this is really the end, probably 0.5, that it's safe, and 0.5 that it's polluted. And now what happens? Well, we now have another choice. If it's safe, what do we do? If we say
discovered there's nothing wrong with it, with the cheaper parcel of land. It's clean. So we could either buy, call this parcel A, let's just define, call this parcel A and call this one parcel B. Alright? So when we get to here, we could either buy A or we could buy B. If it turns out B isn't polluted, which one do we want to buy? B, obviously, right? So that's, so this one is minus 300,000. Sorry, this is why I'm doing this on the computer, because you could read it. And this is minus 250. Obviously, we take this option. Cut off that. And this one is then minus 250. Now, how about here? Suppose it is polluted. And I'm going to assume the numbers here, again, it's 120,000 for a cleanup. If it is polluted, then the if we get B, we pay 250,000 plus another 120,000, so our cost is then 370,000 minus. A is still its usual 300,000. So if it's polluted, which we do, buy A. So we cut off this branch. That tells us that this is worth minus 300,000. So we now have a 50% chance of minus 250, a 50% chance of minus 300. So adding those up, this one is now worth minus 275. Clear? Everybody? Again, I mean, some people clearly are bothering. Anybody have
questions? Yeah, we're 275.
By taking a half of this plus half of this, halfway between, right? Just the average. So we now say, but there's also this 20,000. So that tells us that the net effect of testing is a cost of 295,000. All right? And that's better than A. And on the numbers I've got this time, B is even worse than A. So on that particular set of numbers, the right answer is that when we've done that, we can then cut off those two, and we know we want to test them. So if you look at what I've just done, it's a calculation of the value of information. All right? We are saying, how much is it worth to know whether or not it is? Well, we do that by saying, if we knew that, 50% chance we go here, 50% chance we go there. Once we know which way to go. So in effect, what the test does is it buys us the option of buying A if B is polluted, buy B if B is polluted. 50% chance of each outcome, that the result of that is the 275,000 cost. Test costs 20,000, 295,000. If both of the other options are worse than that, we do the test. If one of the options is better, we don't do the test. All right. So that, I think, sorry, it's such a mess. Should probably have drawn this up and done it up on the screen, but I haven't yet gotten set up for doing that in this room. Well, surely can. So that's the basic logic of decision analysis. And again, in each time, you start at the far end on your last choice and then work back. All right? Consider another case. I don't think it's in the book, but maybe it is, but it's the same basic issue. And that is that this time your firm is in the business of doing hazardous materials disposal. And you are suspect that your employees may have broken something and that you have done stuff that you shouldn't have done. So the first choice is investigate. Don't. Do you check up to see whether or not they have done that? Right? And if you don't investigate, then there are two possibilities. In fact, in both of these, there are two possibilities. One of them is they did, in fact, they they did cheat, and what is they didn't. Well, if they didn't cheat, there's no problem. You didn't look, there's nothing to be found, home free. No fuss. If they did cheat, what's the next question?
What's the cost of the cheating?
Well, there may have been cost to who?
Cost to you.
What is that going to depend on?
Just what they did.
Yep. This is what you haven't investigated.
Yep. The chance they're caught.
The chance they're getting caught, exactly. So we have a second probabilistic one. And this is the chance, if they cheated, of getting detected. So if they cheated, and they were detected, and you didn't do it, you didn't check, then there is some penalty. All right? You'd have to know the numbers to fill this in. If, on the other hand, they aren't caught, then zero. You, assuming you're only interested in the money in and out of your firm, maybe you might have other concerns as well. Let's leave those out for you. If they didn't cheat, I'm assuming they didn't cheat, they can't get caught, but of course the EPA might make mistakes, but let's assume they're not going to be caught if they didn't cheat. If you do investigate, let's assume the investigation always gives the right answer for a moment. Well, we then have the same probabilities. Let me suppose I say it's a 0.4 chance they cheated, 0.6 chance they didn't. So we then have that same 0.4, 0.6, only now these are the probabilities that you will discover they cheated because you investigated and your investigation is really good and thorough. Now, if they cheated, now what's the decision you have to make? Yeah, sure. Do you burn the evidence and tell everybody to keep his mouth shut, or do you confess? All right? Confess. Conceal. Well, if you confess, there's then going to be some penalty. Probably a smaller penalty in this case, because this one you discovered it yourself and you reported it to the EPA, but there's still a penalty for doing things wrong. If you conceal, we then have, again, a probabilistic thing. Whether they're caught or not caught, and the odds may or may not be the same this time because of the course of investigating it, you've laid open the risk that some whistleblower in your organization will report the results of what otherwise never have been found. Right? This is the let sleeping dogs lie argument. So, but then if you conceal, there is then a this is a zero where they never catch you, and this is a big penalty. Maybe you even go to jail. I don't know. All right. So if you think about that, that's the structure of that problem. And if you were making the decision, and if for a moment all you care about is fines and costs of doing stuff, you would then want to fill in all these numbers. And you don't get to choose here because this is a random event. So you just put in some number, which is the if they cheated, what are the chances of getting caught, and what's the penalty? Chance of getting caught times the penalty is the number that goes here. All right? This one is easy. It's zero. You then say, all right, take it back to here. Here are our probabilities, 0.4 chance of this outcome, 0.6 chance of this outcome. What is that total? You put that number there, and that then tells you if you don't investigate on average what's going to happen. Go up here, and you say, well, if I conceal, what happens? If I confess, what happens? I get to choose if the chance of being caught times the big penalty is bigger than the smaller penalty for confessing, then I confess, otherwise I don't. I can decide which I'm going to do, so I can ignore one of these. Suppose we say, all right, I don't want to go to jail. They'll really throw the book at us and discover we knew about it and hit it. So this is the cheaper outcome. In that case, this penalty is going to be the cost here. We could... This is a zero, except investigating is going to have a cost. just run it back and compare the two insights. All right. So that's a fairly straightforward case where you are figuring out whether to buy information, as it were, and it depends in part. Suppose you conclude that if you discover you're going to conceal it. Well, presumably, unless you've got some way of hiding the evidence, maybe you do. If you don't, the chance of being caught, if you investigate, is probably at least as high as if you don't investigate, maybe higher. So if you're going to conceal it anyway, there's no point in doing your investigating in the first place. You might as well just dump and hope you're not. But you could run those through in lots of ways.
All right.
Now, if you're actually doing this, you're going to want to think a little more carefully about your payoffs as well as your probabilities, because payoffs are not all funds. Suppose that you're caught. Either way, in fact, suppose that you end up either at this branch or on one of those two branches. What costs might you incur in addition to the fine? Might have higher insurance premiums in the future. You might have customers less willing to hire you for doing their cleanup because they're afraid they're going to get in trouble. Suppose you are sure that you're not going to be caught. You might, there might be things that matter to the owner of the firm other than the money he gets. Right? The guy who owns the firm might not sleep very well at night if he believes that people are getting cancer due to the fact that his people dumped something that was never detected, therefore never cleaned up. So you're going to want to think in doing your cost calculation, you sort of start with the easy to measure ones. What are the fines for this outcome? What is the cost of this investigation? But you're then going to want to go on to the harder to measure ones. What are the reputational costs? What are the non-pecuniary, that is not a money form cost, but nonetheless measured to whoever you're working for, to your clients, or as they go, it might well be things other than just money.
A further issue, not a further issue, a further step in this
is what's referred to as sensitivity testing. And the question here is, all right, I've got a whole bunch of probabilities and payoffs. How much do they matter? All right, so if we took, let's go back to our very simple case that we started with, which was whether to settle or go to trial. And the settlement offer is $70,000. And take the very simplest case, which is you're sure you're going to win. Well, in this case, there's really only one unknown in that version of the story. That unknown is how much the court will award you. And it's pretty easy to say, as long as I'm pretty sure the court will award me, I've got a $20,000 trial cost. So the real question is, if I'm sure that the court will award me something more than $90,000, then I go to trial. If there's a significant chance of less than $90,000, then maybe I shouldn't. And one implication is, if I really am quite unsure about the amount, maybe I should do some more research and try to get a more accurate estimate of what those are. So that would be the simplest version of sensitivity analysis. You're asking, how sensitive is my decision, which is what you're really generating for your client, to the numbers I put in. Suppose your estimate is actually that you're going to get $300,000 awarded. You don't really care if it's $300,000 or $200,000. I mean, you care, but you don't care for the purpose of making this decision. So that's one where it's very insensitive. Suppose we make the problem one step more complicated by making it we're not sure if we're going to win or not. So we now have replaced this endpoint with a circle, and that is probability 0.7, let's say, here, and 0.3 of we lose and get nothing. Well, if the number at this end is 100,000, should we go to trial or accept the settlement? Settle, right. If the number is 200,000, go to trial. And suppose we're pretty sure what the number is, and in fact we know that the number here is 100,000. What we're not sure of is this number,
the probability.
Well, if that probability is, how high does this probability have to be before you want to go to trial? 9, right? If it's 0.9, 0.9 and above, you go to trial. Below 0.9, you don't. So again, if you say, well, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's not 0.9. I mean, that would be a nice world in which I won 90% of my cases. It's not going to happen. You then say, settle. Suppose, to go outside of the model for a moment, suppose you think it's 0.7, but you also think it's 300,000.
In the analysis we're doing so far, the obvious answer is you go to trial. If you're actually a lawyer, what's the other thing you might do? What's the alternative not included in the way we set up the problem? Yeah?
I don't know. On that last thing,
maybe. We're assuming, perhaps benevolently, that you're an honest lawyer who's doing his best for his client for reputational reasons. You want the client to hire you again. So, for the benefit of your client, if that's your estimate of the numbers. Very good. Very good. We've been assuming we know what the choices are, as it were. And when you're doing a single analysis, you're going to do that. But you're absolutely right. The next thing to do is say, oops, why don't I show these numbers to the guy on the other side? Maybe he'll make me a more reasonable offer. All right. And in fact, one of the things we're going to be looking at in another week or two is a version of game theory which looks exactly like this, except there are two players. So take the kind of diagram we're doing. This is called, just to be pretentious, subgame perfect equilibrium. But it's one of the bits of game theory which, where it's applicable, is nice and clean and neat, but it's not the where it's applicable. It's often a problem. And subgame perfect equilibrium, you do just the same story as before, except that some of these blocks are blue and some of them are red. And one color means you make the choice and one color means the other guy makes the choice. And what do you do? Well, again, you go to the right-hand side. And at the right-hand side, if I don't have colors, so let's make this his choice. And you say, well, here's his last choice. And we happen to know that if he gets to this point, of course he may not, this all depends on the choices made earlier in the day. If he gets to this point, this one is going to cost him 50,000, and this one is going to cost him 30,000. All right, well in that case, we know what he's going to do. He's obviously going to make that choice. But of course, in addition to what it costs him, there's also another number there, namely what you get when he makes that choice. So you can make your decision ignoring that branch, so you know he's not going to take it. And your decision, going back a step earlier when you had a box, takes it for granted that the story is going to go this way, and therefore you can plug in every place he's got a choice. You plug in the choice you know he's going to make. And each time you assume going back, he does the same thing. And so you just go back alternating back until you get to the beginning and decide what you do. They say, we'll get to that later. I'm bringing it in now mostly because I've run out of the things I was planning to talk about today. What's wrong with that? Why might that not be a correct description of what really happens in the real world? One possibility is people are irrational. Is that the only possibility? What's the other possibility? Yeah?
At one step, you might be willing to accept a lower payout for the possibility of a higher payout later.
Well, what do you mean by later?
Later steps in the game.
No, except the payoff, we're starting at the start of the right end. The right end is the last step of the game. Once we've got that, whatever the payoffs are at that last step are now being moved back just the way we did our decision theory.
So at each stage, he's doing it. No, but I was thinking of a different later. Suppose, let's take the sort of the settle versus litigate. Suppose you're the attorney for a company which is being sued for punitive damages for something where you're quite sure that you don't even are liable at all, let alone have behaved badly. But it's a nice sort of rabble-rousing emotional kind of case. There's a 10% chance they're going to win. And 10% chance they're going to win. If they win, they're going to have 10 dollars. And so they go to you and they say, we'd like to accept an out-of-court settlement of $900,000. And you say, well, let's look at this last step of the diagram. And this branch, we pay them $900,000. And this branch, we go to court. And we have a 10% chance of paying $10 million, 90% chance of nothing. And, of course, both sides have litigation expenses along the way. All right? Why might you decide not to settle? You're going to want to say, look, if we don't settle, suppose it's the case that if we don't settle, they should never have brought the case from their standpoint. Right? Suppose that if we force it to go to trial, the amount they can expect to get is less than their total litigation costs. Running through the argument I was giving you 5 minutes ago, I settle anyway because I'm only caring about my returns. But if I'm thinking about the next time and the time after that, the time after that, I may say, look, if I can convince people who sue me that I'm the kind of SOB who goes to court even when I shouldn't, fewer people are going to sue me. And I think if you try to make sense of sort of how human social structures work, a lot of it involves what we sometimes refer to as commitment strategies. All right, the famous commitment strategy is Odysseus tying himself to the mast. People know the story, I don't know. All right. So the basic idea of a commitment strategy is a cape, you don't know the story. In the Odyssey, the sirens are creatures who sing so sweetly that sailors jump off their ships in order to get close to the siren and drown. And Odysseus, I think, has to, if I remember correctly, go past where the sirens are. And so he said, well, the solution for my sailors is simple. We'll plug their ears with wax, with beeswax, so they won't hear the sirens. But I'm Odysseus. I'm a hero. I want to have heard the sirens sing. After all, no living man, no man alive who has ever heard the sirens sing. They all drown when they do. So Odysseus commands his sailors to tie him to the mast. And not put wax in his ears. They've got wax in their ears, so they'll just take the ship straight past. And he will try to jump into the sea to go to the sirens, but won't be able to. And he almost makes it. He almost breaks the rope because he's a hero, right? Very strong fellow, as well as very crafty. But he doesn't. So he's the guy who's written the sirens. That's the minister, right? He knows that when he gets to the sirens, he'll want to do X. But he wants to set things up so he can't do X because he knows before he doesn't want. And you can think of a lot of cases of that sort. So suppose, to go back to the case I was just describing, suppose that you are the litigator defending the company that's being sued. And you make public statements before it gets to the final decision, saying, you know, if I give in to these people's demands and pay them all, I'm a wimp and nobody should ever hire me. It's just not the right way to go. It's not honorable behavior to pay off people who are just trying to blackmail you with bogus cases. Say enough of that and it's no longer your personal interest to settle because you're going to suffer very large reputational penalties after making clear you don't believe in settling. Since you feel that way, they drop the case. All right? Because they realize it's not going to pay them doing it. So you could imagine a lot of behavior. You could think about union management bargaining with strikes. All right. There's a sense in which the strike doesn't make any sense, right? Both, whenever the final result's going to be, they both be better off if they went to it immediately. Except that each one is trying to prove how strongly he's committed not to get in what the other one wants. Right. And you can have a lot of other examples of the same pattern of behavior. Well, presumably when we're getting to the closest of the time to raise the debt limit, we're going to observe some behavior of this sort by both the Republicans and the Democrats as each side tries to make the other one back down. Do you know what the game of chicken is? Right? Two cars played by teenagers who've had too much to drink, and each car has its right wheel on the white line, and they head towards each other, and the question is who
who swerves off. Well, Game of Chicken encapsulates a great deal of what goes on in the world. We'll get to that more in the subject, in the game theory section.
All right, I think the class is supposed to be over at 4, is that right? I think it is. Anyway, so... What?
55.
Oh, 55, great. Well, I've only got 1 minute to spend. All right, I hope you have all filled out these little forms on when you want the office hours to be, and if you haven't, please do. And why don't you call me?
And any of you want to admire the beautiful little computer around,
which I got, 3 weeks ago or something, and I'm still enjoying a great deal.